Hi, I'm Keith.
Hi, I'm Ragini.
And welcome to More Than Masala, a podcast where a chef and a culinary researcher talk about spices from the Indian subcontinent, from how to use them to sometimes the dark history behind their origins. Every episode, Ragini and I do a deep dive into one spice and talk about the history as well as how to use the spice. Welcome back, everyone. We are so excited because today we're going to play for you a recording that we did with Dr. Kurush Dalal, who's just amazing. This was recorded in January of 2022. And we really get into some great things. Ragini and I have been friends with Kurush for a while. And Ragini, I think you've been friends longer, right?
Maybe just by a few months, but not too much longer.
And we've really grown to call him friend, very much so. And so this recording, you're going to hear a lot about his background. There's some wonderful banter with Kurush and Ragini, and it's a really great interview. So tuck in, grab a cup of chai, and really enjoy Dr. Kurush Dalal. Welcome back to More Than Masala, and today we have such a special guest, somebody who, you know, we all call Guru, but more than that, he's become just such a good friend to both of us. Ragini, it would be an honor if you introduced Kurush to everyone. So without further ado.
Awesome. Super, super excited to have our first guest on today. And Keith and I spent some time thinking about what we wanted to do with the podcast this year. And one of the things we thought was we want to start bringing on the people who inspire us, the people who push us out of our comfort zones and encourage us to learn more. And for me, our first guest today, and I know for Keith as well, but I'll speak from my perspective for a second. For me, our first guest today is someone who I am incredibly grateful for several reasons. His dad's sense of humor is not necessarily one of them, but sometimes it is, but mostly so because he is someone who has shown an incredible amount of faith that in me that I didn't really understand at first, and has continuously sort of spoken to me with the kind of confidence I needed to see to keep doing a lot of what I've actually done in the last year. And so I am very, very thankful to you. And without further ado, Dr. Kurush Dalal, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Keith. And thank you very much, Ragini. It's an absolute honor. And to be the first person on your podcast to come in as a guest is a double honor. And I must say that it couldn't have happened to two better people, that this amazing podcast is on the air, and the kind of stuff that you're doing is really, really super.
Oh, thank you. It's always amazing to hear praise from somebody you admire so much, but enough fawning because we will have plenty of time to do that. There are so many questions that Ragini and I wrote down for you, and it's weirdly ironic because we spend a lot of time talking, I would say, at least a couple of times a week on my end. But for the listeners who might not know you and your backstory, I would love to start there because you have such an incredible story. So take us kind of back to how you became such an incredible food researcher and kind of your history with this.
Okay, so we basically got about 8 or 9 hours, I suppose, to do this, because that's how much time it, you know, it would take. But okay, to give you the compressed version, I'm going to really upset a lot of people by saying I come from a family, a lineage of very good cooks on my mom's side. And my dad was a very good cook too. I never saw my father's mother, so I don't know how good she was. And his dad didn't cook. But that said, I'm a Parsi. We're basically descendants of Zoroastrian refugees who fled Persia about 1300 years ago and landed on the west coast of India. And we found refuge in India, and we slowly Indianized over time with memories of Persia in our food, and managed to keep most of our religion intact, again, with some Indianization within it. So we also are people who got along very well with the British colonizers. We took to Anglicization in a big way, and we settled down with the British. We interacted with them and benefited greatly, both trade-wise and economically, et cetera, with them. My parents are both were both from Bombay, very middle class Parsis. My dad's family was from the heart of Bombay, which is the area called Fort. My mom's family was from suburban Bombay, which is Bandra. And she was a young archaeologist. She decided she wanted to be an Egyptologist and an archaeologist at a very young age. Went on to become an archaeologist from the Deccan College, Pune. Did her PhD on the Indo-Pakistan border, working on the Pre-Harappans. On the way there, she met my dad, who was a shippy. He was a radio officer with the Merchant Navy. And they got along like a house on fire. He proposed to her on one knee in a cycle rickshaw in the middle of an argument in Calcutta. And they got married and had three children. I was the eldest of them all. So, mom didn't really have much scope to do archaeology after her PhD, because in those days, women didn't have much of a chance to do something like this. And she tried teaching in Bombay, but she didn't really want to teach history and other subjects. And she didn't want to teach undergrad students. So that wasn't working out for her. Quite by chance, she ended up becoming a caterer. Now, with my dad, she had explored a lot of food across the world, because as a Merchant Navy guy in those days, you could take your wife and your children with you on trips if you had the kind of, you know, years and years of experience that he had with the company. And I did two trips with him, which opened my eyes even as a little toddler of 3 and 5. And I have very strong memories from when I was 5 of eating and seeing things abroad. And it broadened my mother's horizons. My mother came from, as I said, a very tough, very good lineage of very, very good cooks. Her mother was a phenomenal cook. Her great-grandmothers were both phenomenal cooks. And she spent a lot of time with her great-grandmother at her great-grandmother's farm during her summer holidays every year when she was a child, picking up a lot of things above and beyond what her mother taught her. So a lot of Parsi food, a lot of what in India we call continental food, and a lot of experimentation with food happened in the house. When Dad was you know, in India from the sea, he at home from the sea, he would cook very often for us, all kinds of very interesting breakfasts and things like that. And we were a very adventurous family as far as food was concerned. They also brought us up to read, to ask questions, and they firmly believed that there was nothing like a stupid question. They were just people who didn't know the answers. In this kind of an environment, I ended up wanting to be an archaeologist. I did my bachelor's from St. Xavier's College, Bombay, did a master's from Pune, went on to do a PhD, and then towards the end of my PhD, realized once again that there weren't many jobs in archaeology, and came back to the family business that I'd grown up with, viz. Catering. And, well, down the line, I took over the business from my mom. Surprisingly, managed to do archaeology as well as catering, and met some very, very interesting people, including my wife, who had a lot of faith that I could bring both archaeology and catering together and talk about studying food. I always thought she was biased because she was my wife. And then when another close friend kind of dropped in and said, you know, you need to talk about the archaeology of food. You talk so much about the history of food. I thought that everybody was seriously overestimating my ability. But we designed a meal and we talked about what, you know, a Bronze Age recipe would have been like, and what an early Iron Age recipe would have been like, and what a later Iron Age recipe would have been like. And we curated a menu. We had people coming to this friend's place for lunch. And then 8 days before it, she dropped the bomb and said, by the way, we've announced that you'll be speaking on the archaeology of food. So I was kind of quite flabbergasted. But then I thought, you know, I would Google everything and get away with murder. And that's when my beautiful house of cards came down. I realized that there was nothing on Google on the archaeology of food in India. And I had a bit of a meltdown. And I turned to my wife, who said, look, just list all those things that should be in the article and then, you know, take them one at a time. And when I did, and I created a framework, I realized I had all the data. The work had been done. I had read it, studied it in one way or the other throughout my years in archaeology. nobody just ever put it together as the archaeology of food. So I put together a presentation. I still have it. I look at it every few months. I cringe when I look at it, and I realize it was a terrible job, but I managed to carry the day. As time passed, I realized that there was terribly little history of food in India. There was just an absolute dearth of research on food, and people wrote like they were experts on everything about Indian food without really knowing food or understanding food, for starters. The only food that was taught in India was in catering colleges. It was about ingredients, recipes, and techniques. It wasn't about the people who made that food. It wasn't about the history of that food. It wasn't about the anthropology of that food, the sociology of that food, and, you know, things that Ragini talks about. It wasn't about the politics of food. They didn't talk about food in religion, food in mythology, food in media, and so many different aspects of food, because, you know, you can't exist without food. So out of that came what we call the studying food workshops. And we did the first one about 2.5 years ago, and we haven't looked back. We've done 8 basic workshops. We've done special workshops on food and politics, on diasporic food, on food and alcohol. We're looking at an advanced workshop coming up in the month of March. And we've had some amazing people that we've met on the way. Keith and Ragini are both my friends, thanks to the studying food workshops that I've done, and have become very close and very dear friends in that journey, like many others. So that's basically the journey.
If you don't understand why we love Kurosh so much after that, then you never will, because it was beautifully said. And I feel like every time you talk, a room goes quiet because we listen, and you take us on that journey. And for anyone who's interested in the studying food workshop, you have one coming up, correct?
Yes, we have the studying food workshop version 2 coming up on the 8th of March. And we'd be very happy to have you sign up for it. Just follow us on Instagram. I'm sure Ragini will be sharing it in her stories. Keith will be sharing it. Ria will be sharing it. And I'm @ Kurosh Dulal on Instagram. And it will be on my feed again and again.
Now, when we knew we had you on here as our first guest, it was kind of a no-brainer for us. And one of the questions I have, and then I want to turn it over to Ragini because she has some wonderful questions too. But I actually wanted to talk about Ria for a minute. She's so wonderful and lovely, and she's Bengali. And so one of the questions that came to mind for me are, what are some of the things that you've learned from her and her style of cooking? And did you find any similarities or common threads during that?
Okay, so Ria comes from not just a Bengali background. The Bengalis are very clear about Bengalis who live in Bengal, and Bengalis who live and grow up outside Bengal, who are called Probashi. It's very difficult to explain in English, but it means people who are not in the motherland as such. So they pick up various bad habits from outside and kind of dilute their Bengaliness in some ways. Ria was born in Bengal, but grew up in Bombay. And so she has a lot of Bengali influences in what she does. But she also has a lot of cosmopolitan Bombay in her upbringing and her food. She realized that she didn't know enough about her food, so she went into a deep dive into reading, studying, analyzing, and cooking Bengali food, which has made me very happy, Keith, because it gives me all kinds of amazing experiments to consume. And I found my way into Bengali food as a young son-in-law. And for some reason, son-in-laws who are not from Bengal, not Bengali, but not from Bengal, are given some kind of a very exalted status, much higher than we deserve. So the red carpet is kind of doubled up and laid out for us. And I've eaten some absolutely amazing food. Both her mother and her father's house had 2 different traditions because they came from 2 different parts of Bengal. So all of that came in. A lot of the Bengali street food, a lot of the Chinese food in Bengal, which is very, very interesting in its own right, and, you know, an entire discussion in its own right. So all of that, thanks to, well, getting to know Rhea and getting married to Rhea. And one of the things that really, really blew me away was the complexity within the simplicity of Bengali food. I don't know quite how to put it, but Bengali food is incredibly minimal, but is incredibly technical. And just the way you cut your vegetables determines what you're going to make with them. So that was something that I didn't know existed in India in such detail. But yes, you did cut certain vegetables.
So can
in certain
you give
ways.
Us one example of a vegetable that would be cut differently for different dishes?
So, for example, carrots. You know, cutting carrots into large, thick matchsticks, cutting carrots into little discs, cutting carrots into cubes. Each of these would be very specifically for a different dish. Very often when I cook with carrots, the lower end of the carrots will be slightly long tubes. The middle part of the carrot will be thick discs. And the rest of the carrot will be, you know, cut 1x4 into kind of square. And it will all go into the same dish that I'm cooking. That's very barbaric for the Bengalis. You know, they would kind of shudder at the thought of this. So everything, be it cauliflower florets, be it the way vegetables are chopped, the green leafy ones, be it the way beans are cut, all of these things are very, very specific to a dish. If it's a chorchori, it's one way. If it's a chanchara, it's another way, and so on and so forth. The spices used are also few, but really stand out. So Bengali garam masala has only 3 to 4 ingredients in it, unlike the garam masalas of my people. So my family has a garam masala recipe which has 12 ingredients. We have a tansak masala recipe which has 22 ingredients. And that's just not happening for the Bengalis. There are hero ingredients, and the hero ingredients really stand out in each of the dishes. And, you know, they shout. They don't just sing. That said, a lot of Bengali food is actually vegan. Everybody thinks Bengalis eat only fish. They eat an enormous amount of vegetables thanks to being on the banks of the Ganga in very, very fertile soil where you get 3 crops a year. And what else did I learn? I learned about the amazing street food, the rolls and the chops and things like that that Bengal has. I also learned to first tolerate and then love cooking in mustard oil and eating things cooked in mustard oil. I've still not gotten used to the Bengali love for all things river fish. I'm a Bombay boy. I prefer my fish to be sea fish. But we have common ground in prawns and mutton and things like that. One of the most blown away things, Keith, and this will probably tickle you no end, is the Bengalis actually have a vegetarian mutton. You know, you've been experimenting a lot with meat alternatives. This is not a meat alternative. The dish is called vegetarian mutton. It's very much mutton that comes from a goat. And it would be sent to the house of the priest after the goat was sacrificed at the Mother Goddess temple. So the patron goddess of most of Bengal is Kali, and she's quite bloodthirsty, and there are regular sacrifices to propitiate her. So when the meat would be sent over to the priest's house, you know, he was technically a fishitarian, a pescatarian. But because this was coming from the goddess, it could not be refused. So it would be cooked without onions or garlic, thus making it vegetarian. And wow, this entire concept that, you know, if you cook something, if you cook meat, it must have onions and garlic in it. And this one does not have it. And it's cooked with ginger, whole spices, and a lot of ghee and curd. And it's an absolutely phenomenal preparation. In fact, I'll insist Rhea makes it for you when you come down to Bombay.
Oh, I can't wait. I'm sorry, I'm doing a follow-up on this one because it's so fascinating. When you think about no onions and garlic, you think obviously Jain, you know, is what comes to mind for me. And obviously the influx of Rajasthanis into Bengal. Is that kind of the root of that?
No. So, you know, the no onion, no garlic goes back much further. It's not no root vegetables. So it just happens to be an overlap with the Jains. The Jains have a no onion, no garlic, nothing that grows under the ground rule. So onion and garlic is incidental to growing below the ground. It's not onion and garlic that the Jains don't eat. It's everything that grows below the ground. No carrots, no beets, no radish, no potatoes, so on and so forth. Technically, no peanuts, etc., etc., etc. So, the concept of no onion, no garlic is what is called sattvic food. And that has certain Ayurvedic roots and certain roots in northern India, in the Ganga Valley. And a lot of Brahmins became sattvic eaters. They ate food without ginger and garlic because these were considered tamasic foods. These were considered foods that develop great heat in your body. Now, heat is not really temperature here, but is about inflaming passion. So it was all associated with people who ate non-vegetarian foods. So onions and garlic and meat were all in the same bag. So if you were sattvic, you didn't eat any of these. But the mutton would come from the goddess. It could not be refused. And the Brahmin would cook it in a sattvic manner.
That's absolutely amazing. I am
crazy. Huh?
Always make exceptions for religion. I just want to go back a little bit and double click on one of the things that you were talking about in your initial story of life. And the first thing is, you know, the archaeology of food. Can you give us a sense of what that is? Like, if I was coming to the study for the very first time, what is the archaeology of food and kind of what, you know, what does it include? And then the other thing that I was wondering if we could sort of go a little further into is, you know, when you're talking about the Parsis and the economic and sort of socialization that happened with the Brits while they were there, Can we talk a little bit about culturally what that meant? And so, you know, how is the Parsi culture reflective today of that? So two different questions, but those are the two things I just wanted to sort of dive a little further into before we move on.
Okay. So the archaeology of food basically is the study of the food in the human past before the historical period, basically. And then even into the historical period. In the historical period, you still have historical data. But in the prehistoric period, which takes up more than 95% of the human past, we have no historical details. So how do we know what we ate then? What are the tools we use to try and find out what our diets were, how we shaped ourselves and our food, and how our food shaped us? So the fact that, you know, we have a massively carbohydrate-heavy diet today as humans everywhere in the world. And the reason for that is that we became farmers. And we didn't become farmers because we wanted to. We became farmers because we were compelled to. And we had to grow our own food. And we had to grow something that could be grown once a year, stored through the year, and would provide sustenance through the year. So the only thing that we could really shift to was carbohydrate in the form of grains. So whilst we ate grain before, which we collected wild, we specifically domesticated grains and fiddled and fiddled and fiddled with them to give us greater and greater yield and became people who are dependent on grain. So much so that, you know, today we are dependent on just four kinds of grain, really. And if you took away either wheat or corn or rice from the mix suddenly due to, say, plant COVID, there would be massive starvation across the globe. I mean, what would happen if there was no rice that grew suddenly because there was a pest that wiped out rice? What if there was a pest that wiped out corn? What would America do? What would the Americas do? Ditto for wheat, and to a large extent, the same for sorghum. which is what most of Africa eats. So our food has shaped us. We have shaped our food. And there is an enormous codependency. Most rice, wheat, corn, etc. cannot grow itself from its seeds, from its plants. It needs human intervention today. And that's because of us, because we made sure that most of the grain stayed on the plants so that we'd get it and it wouldn't fall into the earth. And as of that reason, plants can't procreate on their own. So the history of our food, way beyond just the historical textual data. So the study of what we call archaeozoology, which is the study of the animal remnants from the past, the study of paleobotany, which is the study of plant remains from the past, paleoanthropology and paleopathology, which means studying human remains to understand various different mineral deficiencies, various different food deficiencies, all of which represent themselves in our human bodies. So, you know, stunted growth, rickets, things like that would tell you, strontium deficiencies will show up in your skeleton, so on and so forth. Then the studying of vessels in which food is cooked, the study of storage facilities, the study of cooking facilities, the first stoves, the first pressure cookers, the shift from terracotta to metal, so on and so forth. So all of that is part and parcel of the archaeology of food, along with studying, you know, things like murals on the walls of ancient Egypt, hunter-gatherer paintings in the rock shelters of the world, so on and so forth. All of that gives us clues about what our ancestors ate. And putting that together in a holistic, scientific manner helps us understand the journey that our food has taken and that we have taken with our food and our food has taken with us. That's essentially the archaeology of food. So that's answer one. Answer two, what happened essentially was, number one, Parsi dress changed with the coming of the British. We took to lace and we took to embroidery and we took to beautiful Chinese fabrics that were coming in as part of the China trade that the British were involved in. We took to drinking tea in a big way. The Parsis are and the Bengalis, so that's one common thing between both our families, Riaz and mine, are big tea drinkers. And it's not the tea that most of India drinks, but it's a gently steeped, very light tea. Parsi tea is made with aromatic herbs. So we use lemongrass, mint, spearmint, along with our tea leaves. And we make them very, very British in a pot. And we have a wee drappy of milk with it and a little bit of sugar. But we also have something at tea time. And a lot of these things are, again, hybrid Anglo-Parsi recipes. So a lot of cookies and things like that that we make, which use nutmeg and which use vanilla at the same time, along with cardamom as the main spicing ingredients. The use of jaggery in a lot of our sweetmeats. The Portuguese gave us vinegar, of course, potatoes, chilies, etc. The Dutch gave us the Ebelskiver pan, and we make something called popotjies, which is essentially a bastardization of the term profayer, which the Dutch made in them. And well, the fact that one of the oldest biscuit makers in India actually took over the Dutch bakery in Surat when the Dutch left and continued to make biscuits. So yeah, we learned to speak English with our English masters. We benefited greatly from them business-wise. We sent our children to English medium schools. We are more comfortable in English these days than our mother tongue Gujarati. We saw the world and we benefited greatly as middlemen, which was the role that we played, because Hindus would lose caste dealing with the Europeans. The Muslims were considered Saracens by the Christians, and the Parsis filled this beautiful role of middleman. And that's where my family name comes from, Dalal, which means broker. I hope that helps.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. And I just want to go back to the tea for one second. You know, in Keith's latest YouTube video, he talks about chai, and it's obviously today, you know, it's one of these things that everyone's like, oh, it's the drink of India, not realizing quite actually quite how new it is in our history. It's you know, no older than anybody's grandparents today, if that, at best. So, the first populations that did really take to tea, exactly as you said, are really those who were drinking it in the European style, which just didn't really take off across the country because, frankly, it was, you know, it was too expensive and time consuming. But one of the key influences there, obviously, was the Irani tea shops of Bombay. So they've shaped, you know, the way the city has grown. They've shaped the culture of at least some part of the city today. You know, the city's expanded very dramatically beyond that, but they shaped the city of what we might term, you know, Bombay's at least of the, I don't know, up till the 80s, 90s, perhaps. So can you tell us a little bit about your kinship with any of these Irani sort of tea cafes, any associations?
So the contribution of the Iranis to the tea landscape of India is mostly ignored. Now, there are two reasons for this. They don't fit the narrative of tea being such a terrible crop, you know, and being forced down the throat of Indians, because the Iranis came to India way before tea was being shoved down Indian throats and set up tea shops. They did this because they were very comfortable with tea. Iranians have been drinking tea for at least the last 1500 years as part of the Silk Route. Tea moved regularly through Iran on the way to, well, with other goods that moved to Europe. So tea houses in Iran were a very, very big thing. And the Iranians knew all about tea, but they drank it black with a lump of sugar on the side. You put the lump of sugar in your mouth and you'd sip your tea over that from a little glass. Various kinds of teas were drunk. Various blends were drunk, and most of them came from, China, of course. So the Iranis, when they came down to Bombay, brought their tea drinking culture with them. And this had very little to do with the British imposing tea on India. So, you know, that's why nobody talks about the Irani contribution to tea, number one. But the Iranis took to that imposition in a very big way. Once the imposition happened and Indians started drinking tea in a big way, the Irani chai changed from what it was, from this tea liquor with sugar on the side, to a milky, sweet, strong tea made with CTC or dust. And Irani tea has a very typical flavor to it because it's boiled in a samovar and kept hot. So that changes the taste of the tea. So Irani tea came to be called Suleimani chai, whereas the actual Suleimani chai was originally a reference to the tea of Solomon, which was, you know, drunk as a tea liquor with sugar on the side. So a lot of blurring took place. And these fellows not just brought their tea drinking habits with them. The Iranis are Zoroastrian migrants who came in at the end of the 19th century, or rather in the fourth quarter of the 19th century, when Indian Parsis went to Iran to visit their motherland, and much to their surprise found that there were still Zoroastrians there who were quite persecuted and whose main occupation was bakery. So a lot of them came back to India, a lot of second sons as such, tried to seek out their fortunes and came to India. And the Parsis facilitated this by saying, you know, come to India. India has been very good to us. And this is how the Iranian migrants actually came here and set up tea shops and bakeries. So all the Irani cafes, as they were later called, were actually bakeries when they started off. So they made a lot of biscuits and mawa cakes and kumas and things like that, and tea time snacks.
Apple pie.
Yeah, apple pie. When apple pie came about, you know, one of the most fun apple pies in Bombay is still made by an Irani bakery. And ginger biscuits. So ginger biscuits are something that old Parsis absolutely love. And it's a thing. You kind of reach the age of 40 and then you really begin to appreciate ginger biscuits. As a kid, you think they're foul, they're spicy, they're horrendous. Why in God's name would anybody want to eat a ginger biscuit? And then somehow, as you grow older, they grow on you. I thought my grandfather was nuts. I thought my dad was nuts. Now I've realized, well, I'm in the nut house too.
And they have to be fiery, no mild ginger biscuits.
No. I mean, gingerbread from Europe would be laughed at by a Parsi.
Yeah, absolutely. So if the tea contribution has been largely, you know, largely goes really unnoticed, what about the Parsi contribution to Indian food? How do we see it, you know, in the sort of public sphere? And actually, also, I want to ask you to tell, this is not completely related, but it's a great anecdote, the story of your mum catering at ladies' clubs, because that's a great story.
Well, there are lots of stories of catering at ladies' clubs. My favorite story actually is not about my mum, but about Ria. We went back to a very popular ladies' club in Bombay, which shall remain unnamed, because I don't want those ladies breaking down my door. And my mom used to cater there many years ago. And then I took up the catering there. And I requested Ria to make sure that she was on the job, because it was all cash business. So in her first week on the job, Ria was in charge of the kitchen. And one of the waiters walked in scratching his head, with a little plastic Tupperware bowl in his hand, neat little pink tissue paper, and four eggs cradled in it. And said, that lady, these eggs, wait, I'll come back. So he went out, and Ria was completely perplexed. He came back in and said, that lady over there wants an omelette sandwich for her friend who has come with her. She wants you to make the omelette sandwich with the eggs she has brought, and then replace those eggs with the eggs you would have used in your omelette. Ria was completely gobsmacked and said, no, we don't do that. We have our own eggs. We only make omelettes with our own eggs. So the lady came back with him and said, how can you do this? My friend is a heart patient, and these are cholesterol-free eggs. So Ria, of course, promptly said, if your friend is a heart patient, she shouldn't be eating eggs to start off with. So there. And there is nothing like cholesterol-free eggs. There are low cholesterol eggs. There are no cholesterol-free eggs. And she said, what is this about we using your eggs and replacing your eggs with our eggs? And the lady says, but you will charge me, no? For the use of your eggs, which you won't use if you use my eggs. So I will take those eggs that you give me and return them to my egg shop.
Two eggs.
So Ria said, no. She said, today you want to do eggs. Tomorrow you'll bring your own fish. Day after you'll bring a goat and say, please cut this down and make lamb cutlets. And the day after that, you'll bring your own cook to cook. Sorry, we don't do this. And the lady was incredibly upset and said, I don't know how you can say no to me. I know your mother-in-law. And Ria said, I know her too, much better than you. So there. Arguing with Ria is not a diplomatic issue at all. So yeah, so these kinds of things happen. We have all kinds of nuts. We catered years ago at this beautiful location right at the tip of Bombay called Kolaba Agyari. And there used to be a line of coconut trees there. And one wedding, Parsis, by the way, in their wedding serve an enormous amount of alcohol. There was a fight. One man broke away from the bar, chased by another screaming man. And first man ran up a coconut tree. And the other fellow screaming blue murder downstairs. And we kind of, you know, got the fellow downstairs away and asked the guy up the coconut tree, who was about 12 feet up the tree, to kindly come down. And he said, no. And we said, what do you mean by no? You can't stay up in the coconut tree all night. He said, no, I don't know how I got up here. I was so scared, I just climbed up the tree and now I can't get off. I'm holding on for dear life. So we got a couple of tables and we put one table on top of the other. We put a chair on top of that. My poor manager climbed up and we said, we'll help you off, don't worry. And the gentleman was told to loosen one arm and he just left the coconut tree. So he landed on my poor manager. The chair collapsed, the tables collapsed. My manager almost got hospitalized. And the drunk gentleman got up and walked off. And a little later was sitting with his friend who was chasing him everywhere, having another drink together.
This sounds like a scene out of Fawlty Towers.
Yeah. So if I wasn't there, I wouldn't believe this happened. And yeah, so things like this keep happening regularly. I've had people complain that they had a 5-inch thick slice of ice cream on their plate, and they came and complained to my mother and said, your ice cream man won't give me a large piece of ice cream. And my mother was like, you know, that's taken over the entire plate. And you can come back for as many slices of ice cream as you want. I don't know what the problem is, but he was very upset. So you have all kinds. I've had to go up to people who were in beautiful suits, not necessarily just Parsi, and say, excuse me, sir, here's a piece of aluminum foil. Could you give me back my napkin from your pocket and pack the chicken, the tandoori chicken, home in this piece of foil? And completely, you know, gobsmacked man over there says, no, I don't have anything. And I'm like, I can see my napkin poking out from your suit jacket pocket. And it's an expensive Damask napkin. I'd like it back.
That's amazing. Your stories are just so good. They're like so, so good. I feel like we could just do a podcast of just stories and we would have volumes. But I want to...
One of my favorite things was one year, in about five different functions at the same venue, we found a drunk man in a suit under the tables when we cleared up the place at 1 a.m. Absolutely drunk and fast asleep with a wallet with just his identity card inside it. No money, nothing else.
That's crazy. That's, you know.
He used to gate crash. He was a professional gate crasher who crashed just to drink alcohol and get pissed.
I'm not going to talk about my time in drinking when I was younger and my more vulnerable days. I might have a story or two, but I did want to ask you a couple of things. So if I want to get to like a philosophical and personal side for a minute, because clearly you are an encyclopedia of everything really subcontinent related. I would say most things, you know, just to be humble, right? So talk to me about your career, because I know that on a personal side, I keep saying, Gurush, like, it's time to write a book. What are some of the things that you want to continue to really develop or do in your already illustrious career?
Okay, I don't know whether it's illustrious or not. It's been one hell of a ride.
Oh, it is.
I've enjoyed it thoroughly. I worked with my mom, did my PhD, came back, took over the business, ran it quite successfully. Much to my surprise, I went back to archaeology once. I went back to archaeology twice. I ended up teaching for 10 years at the university. Neglected the business a bit, I realize now, at that time. But, you know, it's like two great loves. You kind of get torn between the two sometimes. So there are definitely about two or three archaeology books inside me. And I know that they're bubbling to get out. And they're going to be pure archaeology books. There is probably going to be one book on the archaeology of food in South Asia. And I've kind of got most of what I want about that lined up. And I've got a target date in mind. I'm going to start writing when I'm 55. This is what I've told myself since I was 40. That when I turn 55, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to put out a book a year for as long as I can. So there's definitely going to be a book on, you know, kind of an autobiography, the autobiography of a Parsi caterer, which will have a lot of these anecdotes and more. And also we'll talk about the evolution of Parsi food and Parsi wedding food and Parsi caterers as such. There will also be a more in-depth analysis of Parsi food or Zoroastrian food in India, and how a lot of it is gone. But that will be in some ways a retrospective of what my mom has already published in her two volumes, but with, well, my two bits added to that. There are definitely a couple of volumes of edited articles. The first volume, by the way, is more or less ready, but I've asked students and colleagues of mine to write essays for me. And I hope to come out with an edited volume on essays in food writing, or essays on food and writing. And what else is there? There's probably a couple of good novels in me.
You,
I don't know when I'll put time out for those.
Well, like, being somebody who's written a book a year for the last 4 years now, I will say that it does get easier, but I personally just don't want you to wait till 55, because it seems like a lifetime away, because you have so much to say, and it's like, you're gonna do such a great job, Kurush.
It'll probably be a terrible job. I'll probably be accused of out and out plagiarization, of concocting nonsense.
Then you know you're doing it right. That's the thing. Like, you know you're doing it right when you have haters. That's how I've always been told.
Of course.
I've come to you many times.
But it's true. Yeah. But, you know, that's one of the biggest truths. It's when people show such virulent hatred for you that you're definitely doing something good and something right.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you have so much to say. And I know that we talk about Keti Achaya a lot, you know, whether it's on this podcast, YouTube, just us in discussion. I feel like there needs to be an update at this point, you know, another updated kind of reference with everything that we know now, you know. So I'm just saying, you know, anything I can do to support you.
So, you know, those books could be redone. But let me be very honest with you, Keith. Keti Achaya had a job, and his job was to write these books. So somebody was paying him, you know, a monthly salary, which took care of all his needs, and he could sit and write. People like me and you have to do other things and write. And we don't necessarily make a lot of money off our books. We do them because we love to write and publish those books. Am I right?
It's a travesty. I say this to Ragini all the time. I'm like Ragini's at the point where I'm always like, hey, how can I continue to support you? The fact that this is such a reference point for me. The fact that, Kurush, you don't have 30 million followers pains me, because like the amount of work that it takes to research and to know this stuff and to continually do what you do on social media, it's work. It's a full-time job on top of trying to earn a living.
Yeah, but what to do? This is the way it is. One cannot sit and, you know, pontificate on why it's not working out that way. If it's going to, it will. If it isn't going to, it won't. But that shouldn't stop one from doing what one has to do. But you have to temper things and make sure there's a roof above the head, food on the table. And when you love your food, you know, it's not going to be just bread and butter every day, three times a day. But you want a little cream and a little marmalade and a little cheese bread and some cold cuts to go with your bread and butter, if you know what I mean.
I do. Ragini, I want to turn it over to you for a minute, because you've been, I'm knowing you well, I'm sure you've been patiently biting your cheek, waiting to respond to all this stuff that we've said here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, firstly, you know, Kurush, we're all waiting for these books. So just to echo Keith, please don't wait till 55.
Three years.
Oh, no. Start today. But I want to come back a little bit to the Parsi story, because I think that there's so much history wrapped up in that story, as there is for you know, many communities. But I think, given the role that the Parsis have played, at least in the 19th and 20th centuries in this country, has been really pivotal, not only to the economic growth of the country, but sort of in a quiet way to the sort of the food landscape of the country as well. You know, whether it's the openness with which the community ate in, you know, in Gujarat, which can be at least fairly conservative as far as food goes, whether it was the openness with which the community traveled and took up different jobs in a country sort of defined by caste-based employment, and, you know, so on and so forth. There's been a huge movement for a very small number of people relative to how many are in the subcontinent. So I'd love for you to reflect, you know, maybe a little bit on that, but coming into food, the Parsi food in the public sphere. You know, today we see a few sort of flash fancy restaurants which serve Parsi food, but I think most of Parsi food still happens outside of those. And so I'd love to pick up on that.
Okay, so there are very few Parsi food restaurants, though it has changed from what it used to be before. And some of them, like Rustam's in Delhi, do very good Parsi food. There are regularly good Parsi caterers and home chefs who do pop-ups and things like that in five-star hotels and now at standalone restaurants. And those also bring a lot more authentic Parsi food, if you'd like to call it that. Though authentic in food is quite a bit of a bad word. How would I put this to you best? See, the thing you've got to understand about the Parsis is that they are not from the subcontinent, but they have become of the subcontinent. And in that, they had a lot of, how does one put it? They had a lot of advantages that people in India didn't. And one of them was none of the caste taboos that most Hindus had, and Hindus are the majority, whether you like it or not, in India. They did not have the food taboos that Muslims did. And the Muslims do have very strict Abrahamic taboos, which the Christians should have, but they're kind of adjusted against. And they also did not have the kind of extreme misogyny that existed in most Indian communities. So they educated their women, and this in turn educated their families. They did not have taboos of interaction with people. Because they didn't have food taboos, they could eat with Hindus, they could eat with Muslims, they could eat with Christians, they could eat with Europeans, and they didn't have to lose any caste anywhere. They were also incredibly pragmatic. In Persia, they ate both beef and pork. When they emigrated to India as refugees, they did away with both beef and pork from their diets because, the two majority communities that they were faced with did not eat these. So, and when they started interacting with the British in Bombay and in Bombay's clubs, they took very easily to bacon and eggs for breakfast. So, you know, there was a lot of flexibility, number one. Number two was this entire entrepreneurship spirit of not being content with what they had. So they flocked down to Bombay, they interacted with the British. They realized where the British were making their money and said, why should we just help the British make money? Why shouldn't we make money for ourselves? So when the British were in the China trade, the Parsis got into the China trade too. My ancestors came down from Navsari to build ships for the British. And they established the Mazagon Dockyard in Bombay. And the only British man-o-war still afloat today in Portsmouth Harbour was built by them. You know, so...
That's incredible.
Yeah. So the Wadia shipbuilders made their money building ships, and then they built ships for themselves. And they put their ships out to sea. And they said the British were interested in taking goods to England. They were interested in bringing goods to India and selling them to Indians. So they brought a lot of silk, and they brought tea, and they brought other things from China. Beautiful lacquerware, beautiful wood work, beautiful porcelain. All of this was brought here by these European-designed, Indian-built ships built by the Parsis. And when they realized that the number one commodity that the Chinese were willing to buy in exchange for silver, so that they could be paid in silver for their goods, was opium, they very casually moved into the opium trade also. So, you know, today we get very judgmental and say a lot of Parsi-based business magnates built their money on drugs. Yes, but those drugs were very, very legal at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Did they end up enslaving an entire subcontinent of sorts? Yes. But, well, that's the way things are.
That's incredible. And there's so much that we could just... We're going to have you back on. Like, without a doubt, you know. So now you're stuck with us, Kurush, even more.
Thank you. Latrine will get you everywhere.
So I want to have you leave our listeners with a couple of Parsi dishes for people who might be curious, and you know, whether it's a Western audience or anyone listening, if they have no experience with Parsi food, what are some dishes that they can tackle and really kind of understand?
Okay, so
I just have one thing to add here. Anything that's not Patrani Manchi.
The most famous, okay, so, in my opinion.
So not Patrani Machi and not Bansal, right? So, well, what you have to understand, yeah, is that Parsi food is basically Indian food. Okay, so very, very Indian ingredients, very, very Indian techniques, very, very Indian spices as such, but with the amalgamation of a lot of European styles and products and with memories of Persia. So there'll be dry fruits in the food, there'll be dried apricots, there'll be raisins, there'll be sultanas, there'll be almonds, and there'll be cashews, which the Portuguese basically brought with them. And there will be chironji, which is the little charoli seed, and various such nuts and fruits in their food. A lot of very good Parsi food are the famous pilafs of Persia, which became the pulavs of India. So that's meat and rice cooked together separately and then layered together and served with a very spicy mix of dal. And that's called pulao dal. There's also a very, very popular dish called sali jardalu chicken or sali jardalu mutton. You can do either or, depending on your choice. It's essentially mutton or chicken cooked in slow-fried onions, tomatoes, and spices. And it's cooked along with dried apricots, which add a little bit of sweetness, a dash of vinegar. And it's served hot with potato shoestrings on the top, which we call sali. So you can't have a Parsi meal without dessert. And the most famous dessert is the wedding custard, as it's called, which is served at all occasions other than weddings and weddings too. This is essentially a British custard taken to the next level. You reduce your milk 50%. You add sugar to it at the end as it's finishing its reduction, roughly about 1 cup for every original liter. And to this, you add a powder of nutmeg and cardamom. You add some vanilla. And once it's cooled down, you add beaten eggs. And then you bake this custard. So unlike custards, which are usually cooked or steamed, you bake this custard in an oven or on coals. You liberally sprinkle fried almonds, pistachios, and raisins on top of it. You can serve it hot off the oven, but it's preferably served cold, either made in the morning and served in the evening or made tonight and served tomorrow afternoon from the fridge, and is one of the most, I'd honestly say it's one of the most interesting desserts you'll come across anywhere at any time. So it's something quite unique in its own right, even though it's an adaptation. Lots of
it is one of the most delicious desserts in the world. I can 100% attest to that.
And we're very shameless in saying that we make the best commercial version anywhere in India.
I've never made this, and so I think I'm going to, and I'll send you pictures, and you can freely criticize my work. Well, Kurush, it's an honor as always. I know I speak for Ragini and I both when we say we just adore you. We're so thankful that you're in our lives, and for all the listeners, if you don't follow Kurush on Instagram, do right now. Just pause this and just follow him, Kurush Dalal. You just post incredible stuff, and I am so excited for your next class. And so you said the dates again were March. Go ahead.
8th onwards. March 8th onwards for 10 days, 5 days a week, 2 weeks, Monday to Friday.
And I will be there. So if you sign up, come say hi to me. But most importantly, support Kurush and all his amazing work, because we're huge fans, my friend.
Thank you very much,
yes, Keith. Absolutely. Thank you very
much, Ragini. And by the way,
thank you. Thank you.
She's faculty for the course. So you will be able to come and listen to her there too. and they're going to rope Keith in for faculty for the next course.
Ooh, now I'm nervous. My palms are sweating on that.
No pressure. No pressure at all.
It's an always an honor just to be in the same virtual room as you both. So thank you. I'm super humbled, and please do share this with your friends. Let's get that conversation continuing, and we have such a good community of people who love food here. So let's keep growing that. Thank you, Kurush. Thank you, Ragini, and we will see you guys on the next episode of More Than Masala.
Thank you, guys.